Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Donald Trump's strange tweet on the most important issue he faces as Commander-in-Chief, and that is the use of the nuclear arsenal that will be at his fingertip. Hans Christensen, the director of the Nuclear Information Project at the Federation of American Scientists and lead author of their new report, United States Nuclear Forces 2017, joins us to try to figure out what Trump meant when he tweeted, "The United States must greatly strengthen and expand its nuclear capabilities until such time as the world come to its senses about nukes." We will discuss whether we are entering a new nuclear arms race with the Russians since earlier in the day on Thursday, Putin announced that, quote, "we need to strengthen the military potential of our strategic nuclear forces." Then we'll examine whether Trump's earlier announcements that he'd like the U.S. and Russia to work together and get along better were just campaign rhetoric, given today's tweets that suggest Trump is prepared to go along with the $1 trillion nuclear modernization plan for new bombers, submarines, and land-based missiles. Michael Clare, a five-college professor of peace and world security studies at Hampshire College and author of Rogue States and Nuclear Outlaws, joins us to discuss the reversal of course from President Obama, who in Hiroshima last May called for a world without nuclear weapons, and what kinds of deals the Putin-friendly Trump-Tillerson team plan to make with Putin. Then finally, we will speak with Fred Wertheimer, the founder and president of Democracy 21, who has spent 35 years working on government integrity issues and is a national leader on ethics reform and government transparency. He joins us to discuss the emolument clause in the United States Constitution and the unprecedented nature of Donald Trump's global business ventures and the potential for conflicts of interest unless Trump really divests himself from his companies and does not treat the White House as another acquisition. And joining us now is Hans Christensen, who's the director of the Nuclear Information Project at the Federation of American Scientists, where he provides the public with analysis and background information about the status of nuclear forces and the role of nuclear weapons. He previously was a consultant to the nuclear program at the Natural Resources Defense Council, and he was also a senior researcher with the Nuclear Information Unit of Greenpeace International, and he is the lead author with the Federation of American Scientists of a new report, United States Nuclear Forces 2017. Welcome to Background Briefing, Hans Christensen.
Thank you.
And what do you make of this strange tweet that Donald Trump just came out with, quoting, "The United States must greatly strengthen and expand its nuclear capability until such time as the world comes to its senses regarding nukes"?
Well, I think you caught it right there with the word strange, because it is, it's a bizarre form of tweet that is based on nothing. I am to be detached from what is normal U.S. nuclear policy and also what the U.S. military seems to say that is needed for national security. So it's really sort of coming from nowhere. And I don't know if it's a need to say big words or something, but it's not something that's based on U.S. nuclear policy or U.S. military requirements.
Well, one of the connections that is being made here is that earlier on Thursday in Russia, Russian President Vladimir Putin said that Russia needed to, quote, strengthen the military potential of strategic nuclear forces.
Yes. So Russia is in the middle of a modernization of its nuclear forces. That's a modernization program that started back in the 1990s, and they're sort of two-thirds done with that. So they are already strengthening, if you will, not in terms of numbers, and they're not going to build up. So that I don't think that's what he means. But in terms of the new systems are coming in, being more capable than the others. And that's what everybody does when they modernize. They increase the capabilities. And so now the United States, under the Obama administration, has built a big nuclear modernization plan that was going to kick in here over the next two-plus decades. And that will also increase capabilities of U.S. forces, but it will not increase the numbers.
Well, what Putin said is actually quite alarming. This was a speech that he gave on Thursday praising his country's military's operations in Syria. And he said, as I quoted earlier, we need to strengthen the military potential of strategic nuclear forces. But he went on to say, especially with missile complexes that can reliably penetrate any existing and prospective missile defense system. So I guess it's a free-for-all. I mean, I guess to some extent we only have ourselves to blame because it was the U.S. who pulled out of the ABM treaty, was it not?
It was, but, you know, when Russian leaders say these things, you have to remember that it's been spoken in a certain context and to a certain audience. And you really have to step back from the words and think about what it means. And in this case, this is something Russian leaders have been saying for many years. I mean, they've been talking about overcoming a U.S. ballistic missile defense system all the way back from when the Bush administration was in power. And in terms of improving the capabilities or the capacity of the strategic nuclear forces, well, as I said, they've been doing that as part of a modernization program ever since the 1990s, and so that they continue to do that work. So what one has to look for is if there is anything new, is there some new development or direction that they haven't talked about before? And it didn't seem to me, listening to what Putin said in his speech, that there is, you know, a new direction that Russian nuclear force maintenance and modernization is going.
Well, but in general, even if this is sort of just rhetoric and some kind of rhetorical tit for tat, and it does sort of suggest an invitation to a new nuclear arms race, both by Putin and by Trump. And it certainly is in contrast to what Obama said back in May when he went to Hiroshima as the first American leader to do so since the U.S. dropped the bomb on Hiroshima in August of 1945. When Barack Obama called for a world without nuclear weapons. So at the very least, it seems to be rhetorically a massive step in the wrong direction.
Well, on the part of the Russian statement, I don't really see it like that. I think they've been saying that for a long time. That's not to say that they're not important issues to follow in their modernization. As for the goal, I mean, you could also pick up pieces from the U.S. nuclear modernization program. That also includes talking about increasing the capability of those forces so they can deal with the new scenarios they're envisioning in the future. And ironically, U.S. military leaders have also justified the next generation of the U.S. long-range land-based ballistic missile by referring to a need to overcome Russian anti-ballistic missile defense systems. So both countries, and in various ways, are talking about this. But of course, that doesn't make it any better on either side of the Atlantic. And so I think it's important for leaders in both Russia and the United States to stop rattling the nuclear sword and throwing out this rhetoric. Because like you say, it doesn't take a whole lot to get from sort of a general crisis scenario or crisis feeling, lack of trust between the two sides, to where people begin to successfully argue for building, or at least not reducing, but certainly even building more nuclear weapons. The good news is, so far, that does not seem to happen. I mean, so far, both Russia and the United States are reducing their overall nuclear arsenal. That's important to keep in mind. But both are busy either actively modernizing what they are going to keep for the next many decades, or busy building that modernization plan. So they're both in full swing.
And again, I'm speaking with Hans Christensen, who's the director of the Nuclear Information Project at the Federation of American Scientists, where he provides the public with analysis and background information about the status of nuclear forces and the role of nuclear weapons. He previously was a consultant to the nuclear program at the Natural Resources Defense Council and was also a senior researcher with the Nuclear Information Unit of Greenpeace International and is the lead author of the Federation of American Scientists' new report, United States Nuclear Forces 2017. But I must say, though, I feel a little bit whipsawed here, Hans, because just yesterday I spoke with Joe Cirincione of the Plowshares Fund, who has made a proposal that Barack Obama should unilaterally, with the stroke of a pen, take all of the US land-based missiles off alert and therefore turn back the bulletin of atomic scientists' nuclear clock, in the sense that the problem with our nuclear posture, with both and with the Russian one as well, is that the president only has about 5 minutes to decide the fate of the Earth. And frankly, you don't even know that the information you're getting about an incoming nuclear salvo is not caused by some computer glitch. So you've got this ridiculous situation where the fate of the world hangs in the balance, where a president has only 5 minutes to decide whether to retaliate and thus create a global holocaust. What Joe Cirincione is saying is that if people are worried about Donald Trump's access to the nuclear button, and in particular the kind of people he's got at the National Security Council level with General Flynn, a conspiracy theorist, and along with Monica Crowley and Katie McFarland, a couple of Fox News ideologues, these are a real lightweights in a situation where you would really require adult supervision if the commander-in-chief himself is a little bit erratic. So that was his thesis, that maybe Obama could take the land-based leg of the triad off the hair trigger alert. What do you make of that, particularly in the context of what we're learning today from Donald Trump's tweet?
Well, so, I mean, we're talking about many different things here at the same time. One has to do with sort of a step-back look at what is going on in the two countries' modernization programs. That's what Donald Trump's tweet concerned, whether it needed to be expanded both in capability and numbers. Similarly, question about what the Russian nuclear modernization program would. So I try to answer those parts. The other portion that it seems to me you're describing, that Joe Cirincione also talked about, is about how those forces are operated, which is another issue. And here, both on U.S. and Russian side, there are a large number of forces. We estimate something in the order of about 1,800 nuclear warheads on land-based ballistic missiles and on submarines that are poised on high alert, ready to fly within a few minutes from receiving the launch order from the president. So this sort of a Cold War posture that dates back to when that was the way nuclear planning was done. Unfortunately, it's been allowed to survive. And the last two U.S. presidents, both President W. Bush and also Barack Obama, when they ran for president, then they promised at that point to take nuclear weapons off hair trigger alert. When they got elected, they got briefed to death, so to speak, by people who didn't agree with that. And reluctantly agreed not to take nuclear weapons off alert. And so, you know, there is an enormous pressure from, or an inertia from the machine, if you will, the nuclear planning community and those that are in charge of the nuclear forces to prevent change. And so that's the challenge for all presidents that come in, to try to stand up to status quo and old thinking in that group of planners. So unfortunately, we had hoped that President Obama would have done more to change, to reduce U.S. policy in for nuclear forces and also their numbers. Unfortunately, he didn't. Unfortunately, he was persuaded by those who did not agree with that it was better to pretty much stay with status quo. So that's where we are today. And in Russia, you have a similar situation where they seem to be dragging their heels in terms of moving on to the next round of arms control reductions. And in the meantime, of course, they're modernizing their nuclear forces. And there are also significant signs about Russian reckless thinking about potential early use of nuclear weapons in a conflict. Very much uncertainty there. So on both sides, there are real issues that need to be looked at. But unfortunately, it seems like the next administration that's coming in here, the United States, is not willing to look at these things in a new light. And that's really, real unfortunate.
Well, at noon on January the 20th of this coming year, the football, as it's called, will be handed over. The guy that stands next to Obama, the military officer with the briefcase, arrives at the inauguration beside Barack Obama, and he leaves the inauguration beside Donald Trump. And one of the things that I've understood over the years is that when the presidents get briefed about the football and how the procedures of the verifying codes, etc., before you launch, and the whole Armageddon scenario, that it actually has a very sobering effect. In fact, when Jimmy Carter got briefed on the arsenal at his fingertip, he immediately called for nuclear disarmament. So do you think there's going to be a come-to-Jesus moment with Donald Trump when he gets the football?
How he will react really remains to be seen, because as we've been reminded many, many times, he seems to be a different kind of character. And so it's a little difficult to predict where he's going to end up. He's been saying sort of a mixture of things over the last 18 months regarding nuclear weapons, both very reckless stuff, like, you know, say, you know, indicating that countries in Asia, for example, Japan and South Korea should acquire their own nuclear weapons, and, you know, been talking about how he might not want to support or protect, as a U.S. president, want to protect NATO allies in Eastern Europe if they don't pay enough money. And so, I mean, it's just really incredible what has been coming out of his pen for all these months. And so now we hear this latest one out of the blue, which is sort of, you know, I don't know, I guess he woke up and maybe he heard that the speeches or somebody had told him something about what someone said about nuclear weapon. I don't know if it was in response to the Russian president's statement. But out comes this thing that's based on nothing. I mean, you know, our military currently thinks we can do just fine with the nuclear forces we have. And in fact, they think that we have up to one-third more nuclear weapons deployed than we actually need militarily to achieve the roles that we need to for national and international security obligations. So to come out of that one and say, we now need to expand our arsenal, is just really mind-boggling and based on very little fact. And it seems more like sort of a, you know, gut reaction of something.
Well, Hans Christensen, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Hans Christensen, who's the director of the Nuclear Information Project at the Federation of American Scientists. He was previously a consultant with the nuclear program at the Natural Resources Defense Council, and also was a senior researcher with the Nuclear Information Unit of Greenpeace International, and is the lead author of the Federation of American Scientists' new report, The United States Nuclear Forces 2017. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into Trump's new Cold War nuclear posture in the context of his earlier promises to get along better with the Russians. I wanted to walk through the empty streets and feel something constant under my feet, but all the news reports recommended that I stay indoors, because the air outside will make our cells divided at an alarming rate until our shells simply cannot hold all our insides in, and that's Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Michael Clare, a Five College Professor of Peace and World Security Studies and the Director of the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College. His books include American Arms Supermarket, World Security, Challenges for a New Century, Rogue States and Nuclear Outlaws, Blood and Oil, and The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Clare.
Pleasure always, Ian, to be with you.
And what do you make of Donald Trump's strange announcement that he is going to, he's calling for an increase and an expansion of the United States nuclear arsenal?
Well, I don't find it strange. Everything he said during the campaign suggested to me that he would go ahead with this. He repeatedly commented about how Russia was moving ahead with its own nuclear modernization and how our weapons were backward and obsolete as a result, and that he wasn't going to stand for that. So it shouldn't be surprising that he was going to call for an expansion modernization of our own nuclear forces. It just stands to reason that he would go ahead with that.
But his rationale in this peculiar tweet was that we need to expand our nuclear capabilities until the world, quote, comes to its senses. Now, anybody that's dealt with nuclear weapons issues, arms control, and nuclear proliferation knows that the main impediment to stopping nuclear proliferation around the world is that the rest of the players, short of the big superpowers, basically say to the superpowers, you guys are complete hypocrites. You know, you and America have got 7,000 nuclear weapons. The Russians have got about 7,100. And you're trying to lecture us that we shouldn't have any? So this goes against the logic of a non-proliferation.
Yeah, the key word in your comments there, Ian, is logic. And we don't look to Mr. Trump for logic. That's not the way he operates. I don't think he thinks in those terms at all. He's not really worried about the logic of the nuclear arms race. What he sees is that Russia, in his eyes, is enhancing its nuclear capability, and that makes America look small by comparison, and he's not going to allow the United States to look small in comparison to Russia. That's what's on his mind. So, of course, he's going to go ahead, and he doesn't care about what other countries think.
But I thought the one thing he kept saying on the campaign trail was, wouldn't it be nice if we and the Russians got along? And the assumption is that because there's clearly some ties between him and Putin, which remain hidden, and as you know, the intelligence community believes that Putin tipped the scales to help Trump in this election, and there's an inquiry going on as we speak into that. So there's certainly some ties there, and Rex Tillerson is a big buddy.
What he said is, wouldn't it be great if the U.S. and Russia cooperated in fighting ISIS? He never took it beyond that. And yes, indeed, fighting ISIS, crushing ISIS, is his number one priority. And he's said that over and over again. The first thing I'm going to do when in office is tell my generals to come up with a strategy to defeat ISIS. And he's going to look for everybody to help. Assad, why not? Putin, for sure. Wouldn't it be nice if Putin will help us to crush ISIS? But he's never said that an alliance with Putin would go beyond that. And I see no reason to believe he would think so. He views foreign powers as tools to be picked up and used to his convenience when they're needed and to abandon when they're no longer needed. That's the way I interpret his remarks anyway.
So do you think somebody got to him, or, you know, the Secretary of Energy designate, of course, is Governor Perry, who famously wanted to abolish three government departments, one of which was the Department of Energy, but he couldn't remember which one it was. Has he been briefed? And somebody's told him, by the way, you may be pro coal and oil and gas, but most of what you're going to be doing at DOE is nuclear. And they, of course, are lobbying for about $1 trillion over the next 30 years to upgrade the ballistic missile submarine fleets, the bombers, mm-hmm. and the land-based missiles. In other words, all three legs of the triad.
I don't think that Perry has a clue as to what his job will be at the Department of Energy. He's shown no evidence that he has any understanding of what that department does. So I assume that Trump will have to find subordinates to Rick Perry who will actually run the nuclear weapons program. And here, we're really talking about corporate boondoggle. The the buildup of the nuclear triad, like you say, bombers, ICBMs, submarine missiles, is expected to cost $1 trillion. And, you know, this is an awful lot of money that's going to go to just a handful of giant corporations, Lockheed and Northrop and the others that build these things. So this is a corporate boondoggle, and I imagine that he'll find some billionaires or corporate managers to run this program. Perry will not have his hand on it, it would be my guess.
So is this, again, another one of these bait-and-switch deals where he does, you know, I call it government by stunt, where he says, you know, we're going to cancel the Air Force One contract and Boeing stocks takes a dive, and then he complains about Lockheed cost overruns on the F-35, which, of course, is a disgrace, the most expensive weapon system in the history of the world, and the damn thing doesn't work, and it's never going to work. That seems to be an MO. So is that what's going on here? On the one hand, he criticizes Boeing and Lockheed, and on the other hand, he throws more money at them.
Yeah, that's the way it looks to me. I think that's right. He gets a headline out of complaining about the costs, but the people that he's choosing to run his government are drawn from the industries that they're supposed to regulate. So we could assume that they're going to favor their own industry, their giant corporations. You know, he complained about Goldman Sachs throughout the campaign, and then he turns to Goldman Sachs to supply his cabinet with top officers.
Again, I'm speaking with Michael Clare, a Five College Professor of Peace and World Security Studies and Director of the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College. His books include American Arms Supermarket, World Security, Challenges for a New Century, Rogue States and Nuclear Outlaws, Blood and Oil, and The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources. And Michael, you've got an article at the Huffington Post, Trump's Carbon-Obsessed Energy Policy and the Planetary Nightmare to Come. And boy, I see this nightmare looming in terms of the most pressing issue facing mankind is global warming and the climate change that it's creating and the extent to which we're reaching a point of no return unless we stop pumping more CO2 into the atmosphere as the ice melts at the poles, the ocean rises. Obviously, probably only if and when Trump's front yard in Mar-a-Lago, where he's having Christmas, the waves start lapping onto his front porch. Maybe then he'll wake up, but it'll be too late for the rest of us. So the idea that you got all these global warming deniers in his cabinet, and on top of that, he's got his Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, who's very close to Putin. Putin is also a global warming denier, or he just doesn't give a damn, because they are a one-resource economy. So that looks like what's going to happen. It's going to be drill, baby, drill in America and Russia. Is that what we're going to be looking forward to? And climate change, forget about it.
Yeah, that's a good summary. That's a very good summary, yes. Drill, baby, drill at home. And, you know, Russia will proceed on a likewise path. Now, these two aren't necessarily mutually beneficial, so I don't know how exactly this might play out. What I mean by that is that the price of oil and gas is a problem for both of these people, and that's going to be very interesting to watch. Trump wants to see a renaissance of coal, oil, and natural gas, and the more we pump, the more will be on the market, and the lower the price will be. And this is going to be problematic for some of these producers. And the same thing is true for Putin. If the United States is producing more, the price is going to go down, and that puts Putin in trouble. So it's unclear whether or not not this strategy will work to everybody's benefit. I what I wrote in my article for TomDispatch.com, which is now at Huffington Post, what you're referring to, is that for Trump at least, this is not about economics because the economics of it is not favorable to many producers. It's about nostalgia for a day before climate change was an issue, when you could pump out whatever you wanted into the sky and nobody complained. That's the era in which he grew up. He started getting rich, and I think he has a nostalgia for this earlier era of the 1940s and 1950s. You know, this is also the time when America was ruled exclusively by white men and women and gay people and African-Americans and Hispanics weren't making any claims on government, and regulators weren't making claims. So it's all of a piece in my mind.
Well, if they have this conundrum of wanting to exploit Siberian and Arctic oil in Russia, and the more oil you put on the market, the lower the price is. And Exxon, of course, with Rex Tillerson as the Secretary of State, knows more about this than anybody else. My understanding is that part of their strategy, at least some of the people around Michael Flynn, are saying, let's make a deal with Russia, and so that we'll unite the Russia and the United States against China in the way that Nixon did the reverse, where he united the U.S. and China against Russia back in 1972. And marginalize Saudi Arabia and get rid of the jihadis. That's the one area, as you pointed out, that Trump has been specific. Let's work together with the Russians against jihadis. Well, these jihadis are mostly inspired by Saudi Arabia. And that's what I understand now, maybe a pipe dream, but the idea would be you develop that oil and gas in the Arctic and in Siberia. Its main customers, of course, would be right next door, China, Japan and South Korea. That means that they wouldn't have to go ship it all the way from the Persian Gulf, and therefore you'd have the same kind of leverage that Russia has over Western Europe, being its principal supplier through Gazprom of gas. So, what do you make of that theory?
Oh, well, I think it's an interesting theory. I would like to consider it, but I don't think there's any substance to it. I don't think that's the way Mr. Trump thinks. It may be that General Flynn thinks that way, and others, you know, around Trump think that way. I don't think that's the way Trump thinks. Trump is a wheeler dealer, and he looks for opportunities anywhere, and he rides those opportunities as long as he's making cash, and then he abandons them and he looks somewhere else. And I think that's the way he's going to run the government. Putin will be his ally as long as it's convenient. And when it's no longer convenient, he'll drop him. And then he'll turn elsewhere. Maybe China will be an ally for a while. And I put ally in quotation marks because there are no permanent allies in a Trump universe. There are only tools. And they're to be used while it's convenient and then dropped when they're no longer convenient. That's the way he runs his business empire, and I think that will be the way he'll run the U.S. government. So I don't see him having this kind of elaborate, long-term strategy that you describe. He'll pick and choose what's advantageous at the moment, and then shift gears when he sees a better deal somewhere else.
Well, there's no question that this is going to be government by shape-shifting, and already we've seen that in the campaign.
Yeah.
Where he makes these contradictive statements. And the biggest one, of course, is they're going to drain the swamp, and now he puts all the billionaires in his cabinet.
There you go.
And hello, has anybody noticed? But the other contradiction, though, in terms of the issue, underlying issue here about global warming, which is the more that they, I mean, the whole point of these protests like the Standing Rock protests, et cetera, They're all about keeping this stuff in the ground. That it's not just that you don't want to have oil spills in aquifers and water. You also just don't want this stuff to be extracted anymore, because we got to focus on renewables and not keep using this dinosaur blood and turning it into CO2 and choking the planet. So given what we know about climate change and how urgent it is to deal with it, what is going on with Trump, this shape-shifting going on where one day he meets with Al Gore and the next day he announces this tool of the fossil fuel industry as he's head of EPA?
Yeah, well, I think you're right about that, Ian. I think that was just that was just to throw a little sand in the faces of those of us who care about climate change, but it has no significance whatsoever. Climate change is not on his agenda, and it's not going to be on his agenda.
Well, did he? But what do you think? Anything happened in that meeting with the Silicon Valley people, many of whom are?
He's a charmer, you know. He's a schmoozer. He's a New York schmoozer.
Right.
I grew up in that world. So
right. Well, he had the guy that runs Tesla, Elon Musk, amongst those people. And, you know, we know that from Bloomberg's New Energy Finance that the cost of solar has dropped for about a third of its price since 2010, outperforming gas and coal. These are the realities.
Oh, yeah, that's different. Those are market forces that are beyond his control. You know, and wherever market forces prevail, that's beyond his reach. That's something else, and I believe that will continue to be the case. It will also be the case. You're in California. I'm in Massachusetts. Certain states will continue to promote solar energy, renewable energy in various forms. But where he has the power, he and his allies in Congress, Mitch McConnell, the Senate leader, majority leader, Mr. Cole, where they have the power, they're going to do everything they possibly can to accelerate the production of fossil fuels and to slow the use of renewables where they have that power. They can't stop the markets, but where they have the power, they will use it.
Well, Michael Clare, on that deeply depressing note, I thank you for joining us.
Yeah, I think we all have to keep watching this very closely and try to, as you're doing, expose the contradictions in what he says. That's the least we could do.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, and happy holidays.
Sure thing.
And again, I'm speaking with Michael Clare, the Five College Professor of Peace and World Security Studies and Director of the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College. His books include American Arms Supermarket, World Security, Challenges for a New Century, Rogue States and Nuclear Outlaws, Blood and Oil, and The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into Trump's new Cold War nuclear posture in the context of his earlier promises to get along better with the Russians. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Fred Wertheimer, who's the founder and president of Democracy 21, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that promotes campaign finance, lobbying, ethics, and related reforms to accomplish these goals. Wertheimer has spent 35 years working on government integrity issues, and he's a national leader and spokesman on money in politics issues, including campaign finance, lobbying, and ethics reform, and on government transparency and accountability. Welcome to Background Briefing, Fred Wertheimer.
Thank you.
And Donald Trump has run a very unconventional campaign, both in the primaries and in the general, and he's certainly not your usual politician, or if a politician at all, and he doesn't seem to adhere to the rules. For example, he didn't release his tax information. So in terms of government ethics, and the rules are a little squishy, do you expect him to follow the rules?
Well, so far he is off to a very poor and unacceptable start as far as we're concerned. He faces innumerable potential conflicts of interest from the day he is sworn in as president, unless he takes steps to deal with his business empire. For 40 years, presidents have divested their assets that could cause conflicts of interest and put them in holdings or blind trusts that would ensure that there is no conflict facing the president. President-elect Trump has not committed to doing that. He has said he would tell us what his plans were, and then he postponed it. But he has repeatedly said that he wants to continue owning his business empire while he's president. And that just cannot work. You know, his name, the Trump name, is on hotels, golf clubs, resorts all over the world. And once he becomes president, it is, in essence, President Trump's name, who is on all of these business ventures. He licenses his name and earns money for licensing his name and his brand, and all of a sudden, in reality, he's going to be licensing the presidency. So that simply cannot work, and we'll see what he's willing to do, but so far, his approach to this is someone who wants to have it all. And we feel he has to choose between the presidency and his business empire, and that should be an easy choice.
Well, it's almost the way you describe it, Fred Wertheimer, that he sees his election as an acquisition.
Well, I mean, he's had his business partners all over the world saying, well, this is going to substantially increase the value of their operations because of the name of their operations, in essence, is going to be President Trump's operations, at least his brand. We have various foreign embassies and countries moving their events to the Trump International Hotel in Washington. Now, that can be the product of one of two unacceptable things. Either they're doing that because they want to curry in favor and buy influence or gain access to the president by providing him financial benefits, or they're doing it because they feel they will be punished if they don't respond by using the President Trump's named facilities. There's never been anything like this in the history of the country. We have never had a president who wants to, in essence, continue ownership of a business enterprise that is all over the world. And, you know, there are real potential conflicts in terms of how foreign governments will look at this, what they feel they have to do to curry favor and influence with the president, what steps they will look at other countries taking and wonder whether those countries are getting beneficial treatment because they're doing business ventures with the Trump business empire. It's completely unacceptable. And it is true that President-elect Trump is used to doing things his own way, but this is not going to work. It would be almost impossible to avoid scandals unless he decides in January, when he announces his plan, to make a fundamentally different approach than he has been talking about so far.
And again, I'm speaking with Fred Wertheimer, who's the founder and president of Democracy 21, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that promotes campaign finance, lobbying, ethics, and related reforms to accomplish these goals. So at this point, though, what we've been told is that he will delegate, he'll get out of his own businesses and let the kids run it. And the kids themselves have already indicated a kind of that they're prepared to push the ethical envelope in terms of trading access. They've come up with ideas of even of trading access through the rubric of charity. So if indeed the Trump children end up running all of Trump's enterprises, they've already indicated, perhaps to be charitable, a lack of understanding about ethical issues when it comes to money and influence in government. So they're not exactly setting a good example. I know they've had to roll back some of their plans, both Eric Trump and Ivanka's coffee clutch.
Yeah, well, first of all, let me make the point that while he has indicated he will turn one of the things he's considering, he hasn't made a final decision, turning over the management of his business enterprises to his sons, he is not releasing ownership of those enterprises. He wants to maintain the ownership of the enterprises and the brand name and the use of the Trump name, in this case being his name, which will mean he will continue getting income from these enterprises, and everyone in the world will know that when they're doing business with the various Trump businesses, they are providing income and money to the President of the United States. Now, certainly the first steps by the Trump children do not bode well for the future, and they indicate at least an initial blindness to the norms of ethical conduct. It started with Ivanka Trump, who announced she was auctioning off a meeting with herself to benefit her brother's charity. But the people who started bidding told reporters that they were bidding because they saw this as an opportunity to meet with her and get their views to the President of the United States, in essence, to try to buy access and influence to the president. She quickly backed away from that once it became public. The two sons, their deal was quite extraordinary. They basically were involved in forming a charity in the last couple of weeks, registering a nonprofit charity on which they were listed as members of the board of directors. And the nonprofit charity, which was hunting and conservation related, then was offering $1 million, offering to anyone who contributed $1 million a private reception with their father, for $500,000 or more, the opportunity to go hunting or fishing with one of the sons. They were literally selling access both directly to President-elect Trump and through his sons to him for huge amounts of money. That is completely unacceptable, and once it became public, they backed away from that, too. So there's not much solace to be gained from the idea that the two sons will be running the business enterprise. The opportunities for ingratiating, buying influence through doing business with the Trump enterprises are going to be endless. Now, President-elect Trump has said he will not start any new ventures while he's president. The company won't. But there are plenty of existing ventures, and what constitutes new and what constitutes expanding them that exist. He's got like over 100 business ventures in 18 countries around the world. This is not going to work. And the sooner that the president-elect recognizes it, the better off it's going to be for him and his administration. But if he pursues this, he is going to put a stain on the presidency. He's going to undermine its integrity and credibility in ways that have never been done, as far as we can tell, in the history of the country.
Well, Fred Wertheimer, there is, a precedent in a way that I recall when William Casey was named as the director of Central Intelligence in the Reagan administration. He resisted putting his business and financial assets into a blind trust. He was a Wall Street banker. At the time, I recall talking to some people, CIA people in particular, who pointed out that in the CIA, you have access to extraordinary amounts of information about what's happening around the world that could be valuable in terms of, trading on the stock market, or particularly on the futures market, where you know about what crops are going to fail, et cetera, before just about anybody. And that was an issue of
I don't have knowledge of the details of the Casey situation.
Right.
If he did not do a blind trust, he was probably covered by other provisions that would require himself to recuse himself from anything in which he had a financial interest.
Right.
Well, but whatever it was with Casey, he was not the president. The president touches every aspect of our domestic interests and our foreign interests. There is no national interest question that doesn't involve the president. So it's simply not the same thing. Now, I'll give you another example of a huge problem, in my view, that just developed. The president has just named Carl Icahn as an advisor to him to work on issues of regulation, which, based on previous comments, involved getting rid of regulations. Mr. Icahn is not going to formally join the administration. So he's going to continue as a billionaire investor and trader, and he's going to face circumstances where he is going to have inside information about what happens to various regulations, which could then provide him with enormous advantages in how he conducts his business affairs. That is just completely untenable. And yet there seems to be no sense of concern, no understanding that there may well be serious problems here as President-elect Trump goes forward. The basic problem is, in my view, President-elect Trump has rejected these issues as far as they concern himself. And once he does that, he's not going to have a sense that he has to worry about these problems with anyone else. So, I mean, I just think we're headed for big-time trouble here.
Well, indeed, and in the case of William Casey, he did relent. He resisted putting his finances into a blind trust, but he did relent. In Donald Trump's case, he actually said that these rules don't apply to him. So you could have exactly what you're talking about, not just the fact that he's got Carl Icahn there getting, but the fact that every day in a presidential daily briefing, not that he's taking his presidential daily briefings, but the kind of information he's getting, it would be valuable to any trader. So I think it's pretty clear that the conflicts are just manifest here.
Well, and then there's something else called the Emoluments Clause, which is a strange word, but it's in the Constitution, and it prevents anyone in the government, starting with the president, from receiving financial benefits from foreign governments. And you start to look at the kinds of benefits that these business enterprises receive from foreign governments, whether it's tax breaks or licenses all over the world, or you look at the question of what kind of relationships these foreign governments can have with his business enterprise. His business enterprises owe in the hundreds of millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars, to the State Bank of China, a wholly owned company by the Chinese government. Now, what kind of benefits and relationships will that open up financially? So he's not just facing conflict of interest questions. He's facing questions of whether he will be benefiting unconstitutionally from these business enterprises because of the Emoluments Clause in the Constitution.
And that's never been, as far as I know, ever invoked in any kind of political context, has it, in the history of this country?
No, it was put in there by the Founding Fathers because they wanted to prevent foreign governments from currying favor by providing gifts and financial benefits to the president and other officials of the government. It hasn't been tested because it hasn't come up.
Right.
You know, it sometimes comes up with very small gifts that are given to a president, token gifts in effect, even though they may be valuable, by a country. Presidents often exchange gifts, but it's never come up in this context.
No.
And no one knows what will happen if and when it does.
Well, Fred Wertheimer, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Sure.
And again, I've been speaking with Fred Wertheimer, who's the founder and president of Democracy 21, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that promotes campaign finance, lobbying, ethics, and related reforms to accomplish these goals. Wertheimer has spent 35 years working on government integrity issues and is a national leader and spokesman on money and politics issues, including campaign finance, lobbying, and ethics reform, and on government transparency and accountability. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the Emolument Clause of the U.S. Constitution and conflicts of interest already entangling the Trump administration. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again on Sunday, Christmas Day, with a special program. And in the meantime, have a very Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays. Bye for now.